The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. A lot to get to on today's program, as per usual. To start off here, I just want to refer you back to yesterday's show. We talked about the emerging powers that you see in the world today. Russia, in particular, the resurgence of Russia under the dictatorship of Vladimir Putin. And China, we just touched on that briefly yesterday, but then also the prophecies regarding the King of the South and how that the United States just cleared the way for Iran to waltz right into Iraq. And we've seen this play out just as thetrumpet.com has been saying. Now, yesterday I talked about that as you see these emerging powers gaining strength, building up their militaries. Simultaneously with this is you have this shocking drawdown in forces, particularly here in the UK, but in the United States as well. Now, I know President Trump has talked about rebuilding the military and giving it more funding. But when you consider the prophecy in Leviticus 26, and I paraphrased it yesterday, God breaking the pride of our power, and how all of our strength is spent in vain. Look at the strength. Look at the money and the lives that we poured into Iraq back in 2003 and several years thereafter. And what did it accomplish? You look at the United States and Britain, and then look at the world around you. Look at the world around our nations. My father in a Key of David program, this was on the Times of the Gentiles, a program that he gave back in June of 2015, nearly 3 years ago. Notice what he had to say here, clip one.
This world, this violent world, is becoming one big military arsenal of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, and all kinds of conventional warfare armaments. But as we look at these powers of the world, they keep expanding their military as the United States and Britain shrink theirs. Does that really make sense to you? What is happening in this world, and what is happening to America and Britain at this time in our history?
What is happening? You see this ever-expanding military might In places like Russia and China. Europe is waking up. Of course, Iran and its quest for a nuclear bomb. North Korea, other threats. Existential threats all over the place. And at the same time, as he brought out there, we're shrinking our power, our armies, our military might. We're downsizing. He went on to say in this same program, clip two.
Today, Britain doles out billions in foreign aid as they cut back billions in their military. Does that make sense? God even has a prophecy for them, and it says they're like a silly dove. That doesn't make any sense if you understand the history of this world and these beasts and what they do when they get power. Have we forgotten all that history of the past? Even that in World War II and their concentration camps and all of the evil that was demonstrated by that power? God says it's going to get so bad that there are going to be mighty generals that are going to whimper like little children when all this comes to pass. If you think that isn't going to affect people, well, you'd better think again.
There's a prophecy just following on what he said there. There's a prophecy in Luke 21. This is from Jesus Christ. He talked about men's hearts failing them for fear. Failing them for fear just because of the widespread suffering and destruction. An abomination of desolation. This is the language the Bible uses for these latter-day prophecies. And as he brought out in that clip I just played, I mean, if you leave aside the Bible, I mean, have we forgotten even the fairly recent history of World War II? How can we be sending out all these billions in foreign aid and at the same time cutting back billions in our defense? Our defense, I mean, we've long ago stopped trusting in God for protection. And so what happens when we eliminate our military defense? Do you think the United States and Britain, particularly Britain, will focus more on Britain today, but do you think Britain's vulnerable? Right here at Europe's doorstep, just across the way from Germany, Russia. Have we forgotten all of that history? God says it's going to get so bad, as you just heard there, that even our mightiest leaders are going to weep like little children. The last few weeks, we've been just collecting as many articles as we can on Britain's military capabilities. It's actually, there's been quite a lot in the news on this just in the last couple of months. Recently, just a week or two ago, the former commander of the UK's maritime forces, he talked about Britain losing its status as a credible military power. I mean, this has far-reaching implications. Losing your status as a credible military power? Losing the ability to fight and win on the front line? Is this dangerous? That's the direction we're headed in. This is Rear Admiral, what's his first name? It's Burton, I know is his last name, but here's what he recently said to the BBC, clip 7.
If we do not spend more on defense than we currently are as a percentage of GDP, then we put at risk the fact that we are currently a credible military power, and from that we put at risk our position on the global stage. What worries me, and worried me when I left the front line and was operating in headquarters, is that some of the decisions we were making, and potentially over the next 12 months, some of the decisions that will be made, will affect the ability to fight and win on the front line. And the challenge is ensuring that we're still able to do that, not just over the next 12 to 18 months, but that we're able to do that over the next 10, 20, 20 years.
But who even thinks that far down the road in today's political arena? I mean, there's a few voices like him, who are, particularly as the UK is on the way out of Europe. I mean, if ever there was a time to think about its own defenses, to think about its military might or lack thereof, you would think it would be on the way out of the European Union. It wasn't that long ago, back during the Tony Blair days, I believe it was 3.8% of GDP that Britain was spending, and now it's just barely above 2%. Russia, by contrast, we talked about Russia yesterday. Russia spends more than 5% of its GDP on defense, military. Well, I see here in one of these articles I have, under Tony Blair, it was 2.7%. So it wasn't even that high then. But now it's hovering at around 2%. This is from the Times. Here in the UK, a reduction in repair and maintenance support for ships coupled with a smaller fleet had meant that the Royal Navy was less able to deploy around the globe today than 8 years ago, even though the threat had grown. So there's a lot of articles like that keep making headlines. That there's these looming threats, these growing threats. And yet the Royal Navy's readiness is just not there. There's cuts everywhere that you look, right across the board. Here's another one from the Times of London. Military chiefs have drawn up a plan to cut the armed forces by more than 14,000 and combine elite units of paratroopers and Royal Marines to save money. It's all about saving money. Even as we spend on just about every other program, it's exactly the opposite direction. All the social programs, you go back 20, 30 years, and I mean, it's in some cases, the UK's spending double what it was just a couple decades ago, but not so with military defense. Oh no, that's where you have to save money. That's where you have to make some brutal cuts, massive cuts. It says here, the proposals described by a Whitehall source as ugly, include cutting the army by 11,000 soldiers, losing 2,000 Royal Marines and sailors, and 1,250 airmen. The total size of the regular armed forces is about 137,000. That's it. The army has a target size of 82,000, but at present it numbers fewer than 78,000. So it's losing more than it's taking in. And we'll talk more in a bit about just the crazy ways that the army's going about recruiting new soldiers. Reducing this to 71,000 or fewer would make it the smallest since before the Napoleonic Wars, more than 200 years ago. So here again, we're talking about the direction here. What is happening in this world? Even as these grave dangers are all around us, Vladimir Putin, for example, he's been in power for 18 years. He's rebuilding the Russian Empire. President Xi in China, he is in power for life. He is an authoritarian. He's building up the military. He's taking over territory, just like Putin. It says here, 9 Royal Navy warships are under threat. Further on in the article, this is the Times of London, the cuts options offer the clearest idea yet of the areas that military chiefs are targeting to balance the books. They would come on top of 3 decades of reductions in the size of the Royal Navy, the Army, and the Royal Air Force. It says General Sir Richard Barons, a former head of Joint Forces Command, said that any such reductions would push Britain towards becoming a Belgium with nukes. Defense has painted a picture of cuts which are of such magnitude, given the journey of reductions traveled over years, that they would break the institution. That's from General Sir Richard Barons. That we're breaking the institution. It says a senior Whitehall source urged the Treasury to help, saying, "You have the Treasury trying to balance the books so they can go home and sleep safely, knowing their spreadsheets look really smart, unaware that the Ministry of Defense are going home at night, actually very concerned that they're not able to defend our shores." So they're making massive cutbacks in defense and then sleeping well, I guess, the ones balancing the books. Well, the Ministry of Defense responded to this saying, look, it's not official yet, these additional massive cuts that they're talking about. But why is it every time that the government needs to go looking for ways to save money, it's in this area, never, never, never in welfare spending? The Telegraph weighed in with this on March 15th. This is just a few days ago. Britain's defense spending has been falling for decades, almost halving in the space of 25 years. So over the past 25 years, defense spending has gone from 3.8% of GDP to 2.2%. 25 years. Yesterday, remember, I talked to you about the general reaction. The Soviet Union collapses in the early 1990s. The world rejoices. That's the end. That's the end of the Russian threat. That old Russian bear, we're not going to have to deal with that any longer. But look at how quickly things have changed. Russia is back. Yesterday I talked about the 15-year window of the United States and its mission against Iraq. And now the U.S. is gone. Just 15 years. We went in there. You heard George W. Bush's comments. March 19th, 2003, talking about this is what we're aiming to do here. Here's the objective. We're gonna get rid of Saddam and turn Iraq over to the people of Iraq so that they can freely choose their own government, build up their own government. Well, the U.S. is gone. All of those thousands of lives, all of that blood, all of that money. Listen to this article, though. It talks about going in 25 years from 3.8% to 2.2%. At the same time, we've decided to focus our efforts elsewhere, with expenditure on health almost doubling as a proportion of GDP over the same period. 25 years now. That's just 25 years. Look at the projection. Where will we be 5 or 10 years from now? Assuming we have that much time left before the return of Christ. How much longer can this go on? The same can be said for international aid. Here's what my father talked about in that 2015 program, which has seen expenditure double since the end of the 1990s. According to data highlighted by the House of Commons Defense Committee, between 1988 and 2013, defense expenditure almost halved as a proportion of GDP, despite new and old risks still threatening the country. Well, it talks about the growing threats from Russia, North Korea, and so on. It says welfare spending is now nearly 6 times defense spending, while health is nearly 4 times as high, and education is more than twice as high. In the mid-1980s, health and education spending were at similar levels to defense spending. So now everything's out of whack. It's as if Britain is going forward, assuming that there's never, ever going to be another war. It's never going to be engaged in another war. Here's what retired British Army General, this is Sir Richard Barons, here's what he had to say about the threats abroad. Clip 8.
There are clearly existential threats to our country, and they come in many forms. They come in the form of Daesh, who, if they could, would find weapons of mass destruction and apply them to the UK. And thankfully, so far, that has been comprehensively seen off. We are locked in a daily confrontation with Russia. The Prime Minister said so yesterday. We are looking at North Korea, which within the next 12 to 18 months will mate a nuclear missile to an intercontinental range ballistic missile that can range London. We can't deal with that.
That's Sir Richard Barons, retired British Army general, sounding the alarm like some of these other retired military men as they watch what's happening to Britain's defense. From The Sun, thesun.co.uk here in the UK, it says Britain's military hardware is obsolete because advanced Chinese and Russian missiles could wipe it out from thousands of miles away. It quotes from Richard Barons, that clip I just played for you. He's warning that Britain's military hardware is becoming obsolete. He's urging Parliament to make some tough choices on defense projects, on more military spending. It quotes him as saying some that are quite prominent in the current inventory of Western armed forces are slowly but surely becoming obsolete. Some of the things that they have currently, they need upgrades, in other words. They need more funding. someone's got to sound the alarm on this. My father did in that 2015 program. I mean, we're entering into the times of the Gentiles. This is, like I said yesterday, we're after America. We're after British Empire. Clearly, I mean, the sun has set on the British Empire. And we see the United States just divided. Bitterly divided. Fighting itself. Government fighting itself. Fighting political parties. And I hear all these looming threats. We're coming up to these prophecies like what I mentioned in Luke 21, where men's hearts are going to fail us for fear. It says that right before the verse that says you're going to see the Son of Man coming in power and glory. Coming in a cloud. And Christ said in that same prophecy, we better take heed. Don't get caught up in surfeiting and drunkenness and the cares of this life. Otherwise, it's going to come upon us like a snare. That's the way it's coming upon this whole earth. People are asleep in Britain. People are asleep in the United States. Certainly asleep to the dangers in the U.S. I mean, the only danger that anyone sees is the danger from the opposing political party. But we don't see the dangers coming out from the King of the South or from the Kings of the East or from the King of the North. The times of the Gentiles, Jesus said, watch you therefore and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. I mean, God will look after us, but we've got to be watching. We've got to be praying so that we might be accounted worthy to escape. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to contact the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
I grew up with brothers and I'd always played sports, but I still thought the army was dominated by men and it wasn't for me. I decided to get a normal job. Men at work would often talk over me. I felt like I didn't have a voice. So I decided to go for it and I joined the army. It was totally different. All that matters is you're good at your job.
That's part of a new campaign here in the UK. They're trying to get recruits because they're losing them faster than they're taking them in. And so they're trying to appeal to new recruits, women, homosexuals, Muslims, men who are just overly emotional or out of shape. Anyone and everyone, basically. They see, I mean, the military does see the declining numbers. They're trying to at least get the recruits, and look at what they're resorting to in this day and age. What does it tell you about our society? We've been talking about some of these things in the last few weeks. Just how upside down it is. I mean, it's straight out of Isaiah 3. Straight out of Isaiah 3. So obvious as prophecies being fulfilled. The BBC says the army, these new army ads promote emotional support for recruits. Imagine this 100 years ago. You can't imagine it 100 years ago. these new ads, they ask this: What if I get emotional? Can I be gay in the Army? The Army last month scrapped plans to ditch its Be the Best slogan. The new adverts, which are all voiced by serving soldiers, are part of the Army's belonging campaign. This is the campaign now. Belonging. In one, there's a Muslim soldier explaining how the Army has allowed him to practice his faith. He can go right on practicing his faith. The BBC does say this. Some will see these ads as a sign the Army has gone soft, you think? Here it's focusing on people's worries. BBC says they'll question whether it's another sign of pandering to political correctness. But like most large, here's BBC defending the campaign. But like most large organizations, the Army wants to be seen as modern and a reflection of a society, of the society it represents. That means an emphasis on being open to all, regardless of gender, race, religion, or class. Everybody's included. The transgenders, the homosexuals, the women, and the overly emotional. At the Telegraph, Charles Moore said, in these current Army recruitment campaigns, two things are almost completely missing. One is what the Army is for. The other is why a suitable person would want to join it. Listen to another one of these ads. This is the part about, well, what do I do if I get emotional? Here's clip 11.
Man up. Grow a pair. It feels like as a man, you can never express your emotions. I thought joining the army would be 1,000 times worse. That any sign of emotion would be a sign of weakness. That would have it ripped out of us. But once you're in, you realize no one is a machine. The army is family. I've probably told them things I wouldn't even tell my own family.
What do I do if I get emotional? What if I get emotional? Will the army still take me in? In one, I think this is a 12-month span. Between April 2016 and March of 2017, so last year or thereabouts, there were 8,194 soldiers that joined the British Army. Just a little over 8,000 that joined. But during that same period, almost 10,000 left. 10,000 left because of things with their family or outside influences, forces, whatever the reason. So the military is desperate. And, I mean, you hear the ads. We've just got to get bodies, basically. But what kind of military do they have? I mean, based on these ads. Shocking. There's one more, clip 12.
Growing up, I really had my heart set on joining the army. My brother was out in Afghanistan. Hearing his experiences, that's when I knew I wanted to join as a medic. I was really worried about whether I'd be accepted, but within days, I was more than confident about being who I was. I'm not afraid to talk about having a boyfriend.
He's not afraid to talk about his boyfriend in the UK Army, the British Army. Homosexuals, transgenders, anyone from the LGBT movement, any religion, Muslims, certainly women. Everyone, let's get them all in. And even then, they can't keep up. They can't keep pace with the number who are leaving. But for proof of just how stunning this drop-off is, not just in numbers for the Army, but just culturally, listen to this ad from 2001. This is a British Army. This is actually for the Royal Marines. And there's not a lot of sound. Well, there's a lot of sound on it. There's not a lot of talking. But just to kind of walk you through it, it's basically these Royal Marines or individuals training to be Royal Marines. They're storming across hills. They jump into a body of water. They swim underneath. There's like an underwater tunnel that they have to swim through. And there's a guy who gets his pants or whatever snagged while he's trying to get through this tunnel, and he's desperately trying to before he has to get pulled up by the commander above so that he doesn't drown. But along the way, you have these words on the screen. What's your limit? What's your limit? Is it here? And it pauses. And then the scene continues. He dives into the water. Is it here? The underwater shot says, is this your limit? And then toward the end of the ad, it says, is it here? Yes. Don't even fill in the form. And then the final screenshot says, Royal Marines Commando, 99.99% need not apply. What a difference. This is the ad from 2001. You heard the ones from 2018. Here's one from 17 years ago. Clip 12, or this is 9, I guess. Is that your limit? If so, don't even fill in the form. 99.99% need not apply. Royal Marines Commando. That's an ad from 2001. Today, the Army is reaching out to transgenders and men with boyfriends and women to send them all to the front lines, presumably. Now, today it's an organization that's been taken over by the PC police. This is the state of the British Army. The Telegraph says, in the face of external threats and massive budget constraints, the latest very public direction from the Army is to drop the use of sir, or indeed ma'am, when answering the telephone, for fear of giving some offense to the person at the far end. This comes alongside notices not to use language like mankind, chaps, or gentleman's agreement. That's 2018. 2001, all that you saw on this ad, I mean, it didn't specifically say it on screen, and I'm sure they had women in the military back then, but all that you saw in this scene, reaching out to potential recruits, were strong, healthy young men, courageous young men. And they asked, what's your limit? What is your limit? Back to that BBC piece. It says the new ads come against the backdrop of an army straining to retain and recruit soldiers for a number of years. I mean, this has been ongoing. The military, as the article goes on and says, it's being hollowed out. They're losing more than they're taking in. The Telegraph, this is Charles Moore. This is, as he says, this is what's missing from these new ads, from this new campaign. What's missing is the purpose of the army, that it's to defend queen and country, and where necessary, fight and kill their enemies. In the What We Stand For section of the Army's official website, courage, loyalty, and professional behavior are rightly mentioned, but fighting, killing the Queen and Britain are not. You can't even find it at the Army website. Even the words defend or defense do not appear, except for a phrase about being a disciplined force. The mission statement could apply just as well to school teachers. That's from the Army website. It has a mission statement that could just as easily apply to school teachers as it does the British Army. It's shocking. It's also prophesied. Isaiah 3 and verse 12, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women shall rule over them. O my people, they which lead you, cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths." What a difference. Even when you just compare it to 17 years ago, I mean, but go back to 100 years ago. I mentioned before that when we went through that Manchester book on Churchill, he was covering the World War I period. This is just a 100 years ago. And I mean, British soldiers were being slaughtered in trenches. And yet the young British men were showing up in droves to fight for king and country, to travel abroad, to fight for the empire. Manchester talks about Churchill himself feeling like that when he was younger, he didn't have the kind of courage that he needed to have. And so he set out to build up a reputation of personal courage. Manchester says, apart from its political value, physical courage had an intrinsic value in his eyes, and the lack of it was shameful. I mean, there may have been some political payoff later to some of his courageous acts, but there was also just a general sentiment across society back then that to be a coward, I mean, that was a shame. That was shameful. Manchester says on page 222 of his book, under Victoria, here it goes back even a little further than 100 years. It says, under Victoria, one regiment or another had been in action every year, somewhere on five continents, fighting from Aden and Afghanistan to Zululand and the Zor Valley. They were almost always victorious. One reason was their sublime, unfathomable courage. He says, an astonishing number actually enjoyed courting death. That's during Victoria's reign, the Victorian age. An astonishing number of young British soldiers who actually seemed like they enjoyed courting death. Churchill was one of them to come out of that same era. Even 17 years ago, you could see what they were promoting, what they were advertising, what they needed. This is what we need. We need young, courageous men. And if you're not that, don't even bother applying. Don't even bother filling out the form. 99.99% need not apply, they said back in 2001. And today they've got a mission statement that could easily apply to a group of school teachers. All of this, it's prophesied in your Bible, Isaiah 3, verse 12. Well, even before that, the first three verses of the chapter, "For behold," it says, "God will take away." He will take away from our nations the mighty man, the man of war, the judge and the prophet, and the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator. Do you see waves and waves of young British men or young American men today courting danger? Enjoying courting danger? It's a thing of the past. God's taken it all away. And so many of these ones that, you know, so many of these ones that actually do sound the alarm, I've played clips for you, they're retired. They're done. Their service is over. They're not even in the military. What does your Bible say? God's just taken them all away. When we come back, we'll conclude with some more material from what we went through on Friday, talking about the universe and God as creator. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
In the program we did last week following the death of Stephen Hawking, I referred you to, a few things by Herbert Armstrong. The booklet, Does God Exist? Just a short little booklet, but powerful, a powerful message. And you'll recall, if you heard that program on Friday, that we also went through Psalm 14, where it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. God says to someone, no matter how much training, no matter how much education they may have gotten at the university, if he says in his heart, there is no God, that is utter foolishness. God calls them a fool. It's just stupidity of the worst kind. I also mentioned Romans 8, an excellent passage there, an inspiring passage about why the universe, verses 14 through 23 in particular. Of course, Herbert Armstrong talks a fair bit about those verses in The Incredible Human Potential and Mystery of the Ages. But then I just touched on this Wall Street Journal article from a couple of years ago where it talked about just the increases in technology and how more and more scientists, not nearly enough, but more of them are using science, honestly, to prove God's existence. Now, there's an honest scientist. There's an honest physicist. One who will base his theories, his experiments, on the foundation that God is creator. In Romans 1, the Apostle Paul said, For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, verse 20 says, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, the physical that is, so they are without excuse. Yes, indeed. They're without excuse because creation itself is proof of God's existence. The heavens declare his glory, as Psalm 19:1 says. Look around, Paul says. But what does it say? It continues in that same passage, Romans 1, and says that because when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Their heart went dark. Last week, I played a few excerpts from this this video from back in 2004 called The Privileged Planet. I think you can get to that on YouTube if you run a search. But let me just play what we have time for anyway. A couple more clips from that 2004 video. Here's clip three.
In his search for a more elegant description of the solar system, Nicholas Copernicus was motivated by his desire to comprehend what he called the mechanism of the universe, wrought for us by a supremely good and orderly creator. The system, the best and most orderly artist of all, framed for our sake.
And so he imagined this analogy of a workman, a craftsman, making something that worked well and was beautiful. And that analogy, it wasn't one of his conclusions. That analogy was one of his assumptions.
The founders of modern science, like Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Newton himself, believed that the universe was the product of a mind, that it was intelligible to beings like ourselves because the universe itself was the product of an intelligent being.
They were driven by this notion that this was essentially a theological quest. They were uncovering God's handiwork in the way the world worked. I mean, what a thought, that we can glimpse the mind of God, we can actually figure out how God put the universe together. There's a hidden subtext in nature which can be exposed through this procedure we call science.
That one I played for you on Friday, here again, just highlighting the fact that so many of these founding fathers of modern science, like Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Newton, they believed that the universe was a product of an all-powerful, supreme being, a godly mind. Going back to this Wall Street Journal piece, this is from 2014. It says, as factors continue to be discovered, the number of possible planets hit zero and kept going. In other words, the odds turned against any planet in the universe supporting life, including this one. Probability said that even we shouldn't be here. This is going back to, again, history, but it says here, today, there are more than 200 known parameters necessary for a planet to support life, every single one of which must be perfectly met or the whole thing falls apart. It gives this example, without a massive planet like Jupiter nearby, whose gravity will draw away asteroids, 1,000 times as many would hit Earth's surface. So all these things have to be perfectly in place for our planet, for any planet, to sustain human life. Recently, National Geographic had this article titled, One Strange Rock. It pointed out six things that make life on Earth possible. Like the Wall Street Journal brings out, though, there's at least 200, more, well over 200, 200 things that have to be just so in order to make life possible on Earth. The National Geographic just goes through six of them. For one, it says our location is far from many hazards. I played that clip last week where the commentator was saying location, location, location. Here we are, just perfectly situated. The National Geographic says there are relatively few stars near the sun, reducing risk to Earth from gravitational tugs, gamma ray bursts, or collapsing stars called supernova. And then with respect to our own star, the second thing that makes possible life on Earth is that our sun is strong, is a stable and long-lasting star. And then, of course, we're just the right distance from the sun to where it's not too hot, it's not too cold. Here's another clip from that video, the 2004 video, The Privileged Planet, clip four.
We orbit what is known as a spectral type G2 dwarf main sequence star. It is well suited for our needs. If the sun were less massive, like 90% of the stars in the galaxy, the habitable zone would be smaller. To remain within its boundaries, the Earth would have to be positioned closer to its star. Here, increased gravity would lock our planet's rotation into synchronization with its orbit. While one side of the Earth continually faced the sun and increased radiation from solar flares, the dark side of the planet would lay shrouded in perpetual cold and ice. It is unlikely complex life could tolerate these drastic extremes in temperature.
And so it's just where it's perfect for both sides. Our sun, stable, long-lasting. A third reason that the National Geographic points out is on the distance. The distance between Earth and the sun, I don't think it lists it here. I believe it's 93 million miles. But it refers here to the Goldilocks zone. That's something that Joel Hilliker picks up on, that example or analogy. It's just perfect. The Goldilocks zone, the perfect seat in the universe. Another clip here from The Privileged Planet, clip 5.
It is now widely recognized that the chemical properties of water are exquisitely suited for carbon-based life. These properties include water's ability to dissolve and transport the chemical nutrients vital to all living organisms, and its unmatched capacity to absorb heat from the sun, a process critical for regulating the Earth's surface temperature. In liquid form, water is an extraordinary substance. And its existence hinges upon another factor essential to complex life, a planet's distance from its home star.
It's like what they say in real estate, location, location, location. A habitable planet lives in what we call the Goldilocks zone. It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. And when I say just right, I mean just right for water.
Liquid water really helps define the habitable zone. If it's too hot, again, the water just boils away, you just can't get condensed water. It's too cold, as in Mars today, it freezes out.
Within our solar system, the habitable zone is relatively narrow, beginning well outside the orbit of Venus and ending short of the orbit of Mars. If the Earth were just 5% closer to the Sun, it would be subject to the same fate as Venus. A runaway greenhouse effect with temperatures rising to nearly 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Conversely, if the Earth were 20% farther from its home star, carbon dioxide clouds would form in its upper atmosphere, initiating the cycle of ice and cold that has sterilized Mars.
Fascinating stuff there, too, about the water, the liquid. If we were just a little bit closer or a little bit farther away, I mean, the fact that we have all this liquid form, all this water, this extraordinary substance, it hinges on these critical factors. National Geographic goes on to say, the fourth one being, we have the right stuff to host a dynamic core. The fifth thing that it points out, we have a big moon to stabilize our axial wobble. Geographic says here, Earth is tilted with respect to the sun and teeters as it spins. This tiny wobble can shift the climate from hot to icy every 41,000 years and might vary more without the moon's stabilizing pull. So even the moon, our moon, is situated just right. That's brought out in this same video as well. Here's clip 6.
For a size of planet like Earth, our moon is big. The current thinking is that if our moon didn't exist, neither would we.
One-fourth the size of the Earth, the moon's powerful gravitational pull stabilizes the angle of its axis at a nearly constant 23.5 degrees. This ensures relatively temperate seasonal changes, and the only climate in the solar system mild enough to sustain complex living organisms.
If our moon didn't exist, neither would we. Yet another. Perfect. Is this all of this just coincidence? I mean, to say that there wasn't a mind behind all of this is just utter foolishness. That's what your Bible says. Psalm 14. Only a fool could look at all of this. Only a fool could consider all of this and say there is no God. Look at how many fools we have in the world today. Quite a lot of people don't believe in God. Well, again, you can look at that National Geographic and probably find this article online. The sixth and final point that it brings out is that Earth has an ozone layer to block harmful rays. It's not a really lengthy article. I think there's more pictures than there are actual points. But a fascinating look, together with that video from 2004, The Privileged Planet. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. As always, we thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.